How has everyone's event been this week? Are you happy you toughed it out until Thursday? What time did you all get up this morning? 6 p.m. from the night before? Excellent. I've had a lot of fun. So I guess this means we're supposed to go ahead and get started. So today's topic, what I want to talk with you about is building the modern analytics architecture. So we're going to be talking about Hadoop, some big data issues, some traditional data warehousing issues. But if you've come here today to watch me do some mad map reduce Java command line coding things right now, this isn't the session for you. Because we're going to be talking architecture, but not so many boxes and lines, but why we might go about dealing with big data and big data architectures, and specifically HD Insight, in addition to the traditional way we've done data warehousing. So that means if you did come in from all this, this is the time for you to respond to that nagging boss's email asking you both, when is your trip report going to be due, as well as can you handle this production call, right? So we want you in sessions and working at the same time, I know. So I'm Karen Lopez. I'm DataChick on Twitter. I'm a senior project manager and architect, which means that I draw boxes and lines all day, among other things. And I'm a SQL Server MVP, and I am also a chapter leader of the Toronto SQL Server User Group, which means that you should find a SQL Server User Group from PASS, the Professional Association for SQL Server, in your own local area all around the world if you'd like to hear more about new technologies in SQL Server. I also tend to blog a bit and use social media a bit. I think I might even live tweet my own session. So what we're going to be doing today is we're talking a lot about the architecture story in data warehousing. So I said I wasn't going to be coding up here, but that means that I like to talk in terms of what we do in terms of cost, benefit, and risk, and why we should do something. So unlike people who just like to talk about the technology for the sake of technology, I want to talk about why an organization or a business would want to use these things. I'm going to talk about how that's different from just finding a tool and then going to search for a problem for it. We're going to talk about how Microsoft Azure supports big data analytics along with traditional SQL Server. And we're going to talk about importing external data, a little bit about using Power Query and Power Viewer to bring it all together. But there were some great deep dive sessions for those already. So if you're looking for a how-to on how those work or the most beautiful visualizations for those, you should probably pick up those session recordings. And then I'm going to leave about 15 minutes at the end for Q&A, but that doesn't mean you have to leave your questions at the end. If you have a question, I can't see a lot of the people for you under the light, so you might have to stand up and do a little dance in order to get my attention. But feel free to ask questions as I go along. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the components of modern analytic architectures. So the big word today, these days, is Hadoop, right? So how many people are at an organization that is using Hadoop and Hadoop stack technologies in production? Okay. I think I see 1.5 hands up, but that guy might just have been scratching his ear. So that's excellent. I think that this is a really big change that's happening over the last few years in the evolution and almost revolutionary way of how we think of data. But some of the other buzzwords that come along with talking about Hadoop and big data and analytics are, of course, the cloud, which is why we're talking Microsoft Azure today, as well as things like scalability, analytics. Then we have these great buzzwords. Everyone working on their data reservoir? Just their data lake? Do you even know what these are? Yeah, me too. So data lake and data reservoir, I think, are different terms for using hybrid technologies and approaches to thinking about our enterprise data. So I'm waiting for data pond and data ocean and data wave. What else can we think about here, right? So one of the other things is what the big buzzwords right now for big data are the three Vs, so variety, velocity, and volume. So we get the volume thing from big data. But I think that's the most misleading part about these technologies is that yes, this is about high volume data, but we also do some pretty big data warehouses, right? Petabyte-sized data warehouses, definitely multi-terabyte-sized data warehouses. It's not just that. It's not just about all of a sudden, you know, we think that we've had small data, and pardon me for a minute. Just realized I forgot to plug in my laptop, and it's being green by going to sleep. So, one of the other things that the words that come with big data, oh, by the way, did you ever notice how big data has to be capitalized? We don't capitalize data, but we have to capitalize big data. So that, for me, is also the sign that it could be a bit of a buzzword or a silver bullet in cases where it's being misused. And I think the biggest way, like any technology, that these things are misused is if people start with the solution and go look for the questions that they want to solve. So a lot of the questions I had in the booth and at Ask the Experts this week was that, why do I need Hadoop? And I'd say my question back to you is, why would you need Hadoop? Why would you need big data? And I get some of the answers of, well, we don't have that big of data, but maybe the reason you don't have big data solutions and information coming into your ecosystem is because your current systems would just have to be so completely re-architected to do it. So the story I use, the data story I use for this, is if you think in terms of utilities and smart meters. So the utility business, while being innovative in renewable energies and green space and everything, pretty much meters are pretty much the same, have been giving the same type of readings. You have a premise, you have a number of some type, you have a meter ID that's tied to a premise, that's tied to an account, which generates a bill. And maybe your meter at your home got read 9 or 10 times a year with a couple times just as an estimated reading. Then we throw smart meters into the mix. So smart meters probably take a measurement or report a measurement every 15 minutes. So now all of a sudden you have 10 million customers and maybe, you know, many times more that of meters times 15 minutes a day or every 15 minutes instead of 9 times a year. All of a sudden, all that data coming into your systems is much larger, and probably your current architectures, while could be re-architected to deal with all that sensor data, maybe you don't need that to be happening right inside your transactional systems. Or maybe you don't need to load all of that level of stuff into your data warehouse to determine what's the right time of day to start billing more. The other example, like I work a lot in retail. And in retail world, there's some big data, like point of sale transactions. If you have a lot of stores and a lot of line items on your transactions, especially if you're in a retail industry that tends to have a large market basket like grocery store where there might be hundreds of items on a particular transaction. But the big data that retail world's looking at are things like video analytics. So being able to watch someone come into their store, do facial recognition, match them up to a customer, capture all of their behaviors, like where did they walk in the store, what did they look at, what products did they pick up, how did they use those, did they put it into their shopping cart, did they take it back out, how long did they look at an end cap, how long did they look at a promotional sign, did they stop and have coffee, did they do any of those things, and you're trying to identify, that's where we're becoming our own sensors. So a lot of the examples that are used in demos for sensor data are things like web logs, which is really the virtual version of those video analytics in retail. So someone comes to your e-commerce site, you keep track of every page they loaded, every button they clicked on, which button did they click on that actually added the item to their shopping cart, which version of the product did they actually add to their shopping cart, because you might present slightly different versions, you might be doing A/B testing in those things. All of these things, yes, we could handle with our current tools, but why wouldn't we use the types of technologies that were optimized for handle that large volume variety with lots of spikes in it? So the other example from retail, of course, is Black Friday. The other example in retail is Domino's on Super Bowl Sunday, where, you know, they have to have this scalability for things. So those are all reasons why people might go to the cloud and to other technologies. There are also some other V's that people talk about. So they add value. So somehow big data is more valuable than regular data. I don't quite believe that. I think that came about from people collecting data just because they could, and someone finally realized we should collect data that we have value for. The final one is schemaless. One of the reasons why people consider NoSQL and big data technologies is that we think about them and we deal with them a little bit differently. So if you've been working in the SQL Server world or in relational technologies, you think about the fact that we're trying to set a structure to the data because we're trying really hard to keep bad data out of our persistent database systems. So that's why we have constraints and referential integrity and all of those things. In the big data world, we don't really care about those things, not because they're not important, but because in the example of the smart meter, when we did old meter readings, we had a little app on a device that we wanted to make sure that the person captured a valid reading, a valid date, a valid account. Now the smart meter is reporting all that. But if the data is a little bit wonky or we're missing some of the readings, we still want to capture that because we have the type of system where we're just capturing that sensor data. Then we worry about making sense of it and reporting on it after it's been captured. And the reason for that is the big data technologies really are about consuming data, not persisting it and using it as transactions. So even in the smart meter world, we don't generate bills just off the live stream of the smart meter. All of that data has to be processed and figured out if it's ready to go on billables. So the next big thing that people talk about when they talk about Hadoop is some sort of ecosystem. So Hadoop is a framework of technologies originating from the Apache Foundation that it has traditionally been done, is an open source set of technologies. And this is just a tiny part of it. And they call this ecosystem the zoo. And it's called the zoo because Hadoop is named after elephant. That's why their logo is a yellow, is an elephant. And all of those names. I've also said that I think in the technology world, we've completely run out of names, right? That's why all the names have become really crazy. So we have things like Pig and Hive and Mahout, which means elephant driver, Pegasus, there's Yarn. There's all of these great names that are coming up through these open source teams. The great thing about the open source world is anyone can develop a widget for it and contribute it to that. So there's, unlike in commercially managed software where there's product managers that determine whether we need to invest and build this, that's how we end up with the proliferation of all these technologies. The main parts of the Hadoop ecosystem, though, are the Hadoop, the distributed file system, which is right down there in red, the long bar of red, and MapReduce, which is part of the distributed processing that goes with all that. There's the query language, which is Hive. So originally, if you wanted to get your data out of a Hadoop file system, you had to write MapReduce jobs. And that was very cumbersome and also required you to have both mapping and reducing skills. So MapReduce is an algorithm that's been around for decades. It's not just a language. Organizations were having a harder time adopting the Hadoop technologies because their skill sets in the data world were primarily SQL related. So a group of people developed Hive as a query language that looks a lot like T-SQL. So it's a standardized SQL, and we're going to see some examples of that in a minute. There's also Pig for that. There's also other types of data stores like HBase. There is Oozy as a pipeline and workflow management thing. Microsoft, so the items there in purple are Microsoft-related things. So what happened in the Hadoop world is Microsoft partnered with Hortonworks and developed a Windows-based distribution for a lot of these Hadoop technologies. So that's what HD Insight is that we're going to be talking about today. So Microsoft has spent the time and contributed it back to the open source community. So the Hortonworks Hadoop part of this ecosystem that are Windows-based are now back for other people to build upon those things. And there's many more other things. There's in-memory technologies for speeding up queries. There's a bunch of other stuff there. One of the things is like all open source, these are all separate distributions. So just like in the Linux world or in other software that's open source, When you go to work with these technologies, you have to know which distributions work with each other, which versions of which components work on those things. So one of the great parts about HD Insight from Microsoft Azure is that it comes together as a package of these components that work with each other. So I said MapReduce was an algorithm that's been around for a while. It is basically, the principle is you shuffle and sort the data. And it has been developed for getting this large data set to shuffle it down, technically to map it and reduce it, down to a smaller set of data that you want. So the way we do that in the data warehouse world is typical, is that we want to aggregate data when we need to. We want to maybe take a subset of the data through the queries. There might be processing they do on it, cleanup we have to do on it, and all of those things. But the main feature of MapReduce is it was designed to do all this work in parallel. So distributed workloads, and that's the other feature of HD Insight and the Hadoop stack, is that instead of building a big honkin' machine and adding more memory and CPUs, what we do is we add more machines. So in the distributed computing world, that means that we add nodes. So we have the work on nodes. I have another slide about that in a minute. I talked about Hive being a SQL-like query language, and it's an abstraction on type of MapReduce. So when you write one of these Hive queries, these SQL queries, then Hive then converts all that query language into a MapReduce job. So it translates it into MapReduce, and it runs on top of the Hadoop distributed file service, or the blobs that we're going to be talking about in HD Insight. The reason that's important to understand it's an abstraction is what happens to solutions when we add layers of abstractions and translations on top of each other? It slows things down a bit, right? Because we're writing in SQL, that has to be parsed, generate the MapReduce job, and then run that. The good news is we don't care, because we're going to distribute that load across 1, 10, 40, 50 nodes, and it's going to go do all that work for us. So we'll take a look at the traditional data warehouse architecture. So the key component of this slide is these are all symbolic. This isn't a reference architecture. This isn't any kind of recommendation that you have three online transaction processing databases, anything like that. But we look at, traditionally, we would have on-premises, we'd have multiple OLTP systems contributing maybe to a staging database or an ODS, then putting that into an enterprise data warehouse. We might have data marts hanging off them. We might create the data marts first and then have those feed into the EDW, depending on whose philosophy you follow. And then out of that, we usually have charts and line graphs and reports. So is that pretty much what your enterprise data warehouses are? Yeah. Anything missing from it that you do? I didn't really call out the ETL part of it, but the ETL part's in there too. And that part is where I call where we actually, one of the main reasons why we have enterprise data warehouses isn't just for the data warehousing. It's so that we can go clean up the mess in our source systems, right? And through the ETL process. Yeah, I've seen you do that before. So in the modern data warehouse architecture, where I think things are going, is we still have on-premises or in the cloud transaction databases, but then we might send some of that data through the bar chart stack there, which is the MapReduce jobs, the distributed storage, either through Microsoft Azure Storage Blob, which I always want to say backwards, right? Because everyone else in the world calls it blob storage, but to get a good acronym, we say a Microsoft Azure Storage Blob. We do all that processing. Typically, we might bring it in with some external data as well, then put that into staging along with some non-MapReduce job and some non-big data job, produce and contribute to the enterprise data warehouse, which may be one or more systems, maybe have some data marts hanging off of those, but we might also have an analytics mart hanging off that too. And a typical analytics mart might use different, might use something like the column store indexes from SQL Server, another type of non-relational database that's optimized for doing analytics. But typically, columnar databases, maybe some graph stuff if we were doing those things. And then out of that, we would do similar things with Power Query and Power View, and then I had to add a globe in there for Power Map for the spinning globe thing. Anyone use Power Map for anything yet? See the demo on the big TV? Wish you had that big touchscreen TV at home? Yeah, exactly. So that's all good stuff. One of the other things is that one of the things that's different with HD Insight, so a traditional Hadoop distributed file system, you build out all these clusters, and you have your clusters and your data spread out, you have your processing and your data spread out on all these nodes. In order to fire up your cluster, you build all that, and then if you want your data to stick around, you have to keep your computing clusters hanging around. One of the things that's different about HD Insight is that your computing power and your data are stored and are in different places. So your data's in these storage blobs, your computing power is there, so you fire up 10 servers of, you know, 4 cores each, and you do your processing, and then what you do is you just get rid of those servers, and your data's still there. If you were using some other cloud-based systems, you'd have to choose between having your data persisted in the cloud or reloading it up and turning everything off. So we talked about scale and nodes. We're so used to, in the traditional on-premises database world, of scaling up, begging for the bigger server, the bigger pipe, all of those things. I find that, you know, that the sort of the biggest difference when I talk about anything cloud or NoSQL based is that we scale out, we add more machines. So it's, you know, we're really building Skynet in the cloud with a whole bunch of machines that are commodity class servers. They won't have RAID drives because you don't put your data across many spindles, you put your data across many virtual machines. You know, there are people in the Hadoop world that spin up 10,000 node machines to do their work as well. So if you think about it, we've transitioned from building bigger and bigger machines to having specialized machines that do those jobs and are all coordinated. More nodes, not beefier servers. I talked about the data staying in the cloud and the clusters come and go. The great thing that I'm going to show you in setting up some of these HD Insight clusters is that there's some quick create modes, there's a little bit of configuration you can do that separately, but there's much less administration because it's in the cloud. This is my quote. It's kind of weird to quote yourself in a slide. But people are always talking about what's the best? What's the best way to do this? And my answer always is, all your design decisions should be based on cost, benefit, and risk. So there is no one best way to deal with an enterprise data warehouse, even within the same industry. It depends on how much it's going to cost you, what the benefit is, and what the risk is. So let's go into what are some of the components. Any questions we have yet? It's really late in the day, isn't it? You guys should have some questions. I wish I had something to give out. Tom said he'd give out hugs. I think I can give out tweets. That's what I will give out. Give out tweets if you have questions. So the major components of the HD Insight version of big data is that we have blob storage. That's where our data goes. That's where our files go that we bring in. Within a blob storage, we have containers instead of those. Then we have our HD Insight clusters, which is the computing processing power that then points to those blob storage servers and containers. We get to use PowerShell. How many people are excited that you get to use PowerShell for this? Really? Not me. How many people are excited there's actually a second version of PowerShell for this called Azure PowerShell? No. Okay. Oh, you are? Excellent. You need a tweet, right? You'll tell me later. Excellent. And then as an option, you can use Azure SQL DB to hold what are some virtual tables, and we'll get into those when I create one of those. Okay. Demo time, are you all excited? This was what makes it more than a 100-level presentation. Oh, good, now I can see you down there. So the first thing you do when you go to set up a cluster is you have to figure out where this data and where your files are gonna be. So just as a tour of, have you all been into Microsoft Azure yet? Two of you? Four of you? Okay, yeah, I'm not going to count all of them. So you create the storage accounts, and I've created some here, but as in every demo, with storage accounts, there's just a quick create. So I could do Karen demo. So these all have to be lowercase. See, it's back like 1980 again. And then you can create, you can say what region you want to have these things is. And because it makes sense for these clusters and their components to be in the same region, you can create affinity groups that are used throughout the Azure framework in order to make sure that you're not accidentally creating things in the wrong place. For my demos today, I'm just putting everything in Eastern US. You have multiple subscriptions. Like other places in Azure, what you're able to create is tied to what type of subscription you have. So when we go to create the cluster, I will show you how the subscriptions I have different limits on how many nodes I can create. I can also choose for storage things, whether they're locally redundant, geo-redundant, and all of that. So let me see if I can go ahead and create that. And that just processes along. I can show you that I have some other ones that I've already created, where I've also created containers. And it's the blob containers where I'm going to be I'm going to put the data that I'm bringing in from outside. So in my data story where I talk about what I'm demonstrating today, those are going to go in there. And some of these, and the output for those things are going to go in there. So let's come back. Still creating. That's great. The other thing you need, you don't have to use this, but I talked about the Hive query. So in order to write SQL, you need to have tables to write them against. But in the Hive world, it's not really creating a table. What it's creating is basically a schema of metadata that it stores inside of other tables. So instead of being a structure, it's rows inside of a structure table. So it's very meta. And I've created a Azure SQL DB. Anyone playing with Azure SQL DB yet? It's kind of fun, I think. Is that I can create inside there, let me see. So in this example for my SQL DB, you can see that these are schemas and tables that Hive and HD Insight are going to be using in order to keep track of some of these data things. Let's see my storage creation. Oh, look, it created it. That's good. So once you create that, you create the container for it. Also, these names, so they have to be unique across all the storages and all the servers because they end up getting prepended into URLs or URIs, depending on how you want to refer to them. They can't have special, they have certain naming conventions, did it say it's only lowercase? That's been the hardest thing for me is to remember only lowercase. And then you can choose whether it's a private container, a public container, or a blob. Now, the reason you might want to use public here, and most of the time you will, is the relationship between storage containers is by subscription, but those storage containers could be used across multiple clusters. So you want to make sure that they're available to be used. So you might put, like for instance, in my data story today, I'm going to be showing IRS data. So you might create a container for all your IRS and census data. You might create a container for data, external data that you paid for. You might create a container per department. I'm not even sure. All of those architectural decisions are, it depends. So I'm going to go ahead and create this as a public blob. And there that is, and you can see that there is a URL for it. So then, I'm not going to create a new database. Well, I guess I could. Let's create a new database, because I'm a data person. One of the things I do is I tend not to use quick create as often. Depending on which Azure service you're creating, quick create might have, set the username to admin instead of your own chosen name. might not have as many options. But you can see in custom create, I can create a name, I have subscriptions, and that right now there's web and business versions that are available to me, and the max sizes are here, but I think this varies by subscription. Let's see if it varies by my subscription. Nope, those are the same here. And then you can choose a server to run it on. But I'm not going to create that now because that just takes time. So we have our SQL DB, we have our containers, we have our storage. Now we're ready to create the HDN site cluster. And you can see on quick create, I can just give it a name, I can say how many nodes. You notice that the cluster username is then defaulted to admin and the storage account. So I'm going to use custom create here. Now, if I went to try to change this to 40, it says that my subscription can have at most, for that subscription, 37 data nodes because I've already got some other nodes already created. If I pop over to this subscription, you can see I can't even create any data nodes now under that subscription. So that's how these architectural decisions are tied to your subscriptions, which is really hard for me to get my head around and keep those things all straight. And in a very large enterprise, you might have multiple subscriptions, you might have them by group, you might have them by whose boss has the biggest credit card. So that becomes an important part of all this. I'm just going to create one data node. You can also choose your Hadoop versions. I'm just going to go with default and the region. And then I get to create a user. And then this is the option where I want to create this metastore. That's what we'd be using the SQL DB for. So I find my database. And no, you're not supposed to make all your logins and passwords the same. Let's see. Nope. There we go. And then I can point it to existing storage accounts. I can create a new storage account for it. I'm going to go ahead and create a new one. Oh, and I was saying for the names, because these names have to be unique, it's, see, I can't type in lowercase. And I like a good naming standard that tells me what they are. And I can create multiple ones at the same time here. Now, creating a cluster takes 15 to 20 minutes or more, depending on how many nodes or provisions, because it's actually making a cluster of servers. So that's just going to run forever, which is why I have these pre-baked ones. And any questions about what I've created? Oh, I was going to show you. Sorry. There's a lot of great information out on MicrosoftAzure.com about how these things work, why you might want to use HDN Site, as well as the type of pricing details. So there's the per rate, and of course it varies where you are and what currency you're on, but they give an example of a 10-node cluster, and remember, I only created a 1 or 4-node cluster here. I'm going to talk about the nodes in the secure gateway in just a second. It sounds really cheap, 64 cents per hour, or about $15 for a 24-hour day. The data nodes, how much they cost. So if you set up a 10-data-node cluster, it's about $100, but you need to know that your storage costs are separate. So I talk about that. That's where data goes to sleep. You have to pay for a place for your data to go to sleep. And then like most of the cloud technologies, you don't pay to move data in, but every time you move data out of the cloud, there's a billing rate for that as well. The other thing is this key thing. If you need more nodes than are available by default for your subscription, it says click down on the link below, you log a ticket with support in order to get those greater number of nodes. So let's go back. Is it time for dinner? That's okay. It's a nice one. Good, we have slides. So while that's chugging along, let me make sure I can keep my eye on it. Talk about billing. Just like everything else in the cloud, you're not talking about licensing costs. All the licensing costs for all the technologies are included in all this. I got to choose versions of Hadoop that I wanted in my class. I didn't get to choose what version of Windows were being there. There's no version to SQL DB. I'm just creating these services. So I'm basically using database as a service or a platform as a service. We're using infrastructure as a service through the servers that are being provisioned right now for all of those nodes. And a little bit of infrastructure, more infrastructure stuff as with the storage. It's per node. So what comes when you build an HD Insight is that head node. And the head node is the stuff that keeps track of where all the other nodes are and what's working, and it's doing all that orchestrating of all the work and processing there, keeps track of where the data is. There's a security node that you don't pay for. I mean, all of this comes that there's free for it because there has to be a security node. And then per data node, and those were the numbers that I specified. Now, geo-redundancy is kind of an interesting thing. So we talk about geo-redundancy in the SQL DB world, where you can put a database off on another part of the planet, and we talk about that with Windows clusters, where you can put that in far away. The geo-redundancy that's happening in HD Insight is really within very close centers, again, because of the physics of how long it takes to move data. So we're talking 100 miles or hundreds of miles, we're not talking thousands of miles. So it's not that type of DR type system, high availability system. So some advantages. The key example that I talked about already was that your blob storage is separate from your processing. So typically in big data, the phrase that we use is unlike in traditional data warehouse or traditional database systems where we bring the data to the computing power, traditionally in big data, you bring the computing power to the data, which is also a different way of an architect looking at things. So we throw computers at the data. We don't just pipe in the data to a server. The billing options, what I didn't show you on the billing screen is the billing options are also just pay as you go, which is what I'm playing with, or 6 to 12 month plans, which gives you a little bit reduced rate. The other great thing about HD Insights is these are tools you know, so they are Windows machines. We could actually, let me go back here. We could go into one of my existing clusters. Let's see. Do I have one of these set up? Yeah, I don't have it configured. But I could go in and enable remote desktop for the cluster, and that would take me into the name node or the head node, and I could go in and manage it. It's a Windows server, and I could do all the things that I'd want to do. The great thing about the software as a service, though, is I really don't have to mess with that unless I want to. When you enable remote use on an HD Insight server cluster, though, you have to give it an expiry date. So then it expires, and then an administrator would have to go in and enable that in order to continue to have, and that's a security feature for those things. Typically, a Hadoop project involves Linux servers, Linux setup, a lot of, let's just say my favorite thing to say is the open source world is not a big fan of GUIs. The open source world loves command line and loves to say, if you don't know how to, if something's not working, right, you should go fix it. But on most of my enterprise projects, we don't have a lot of Linux people. We don't have Linux security experts. We don't have all those things. And that's why we would be using HD Insights, because again, it's those tools and skills that we already have. So this is where the fun part happens. So the analysis we're going to do, oh, I have to go through the story first. Sorry about that. Here's my data story. So what I have in today's demo for this is I've downloaded some IRS energy tax credit data. So the link on the upper right-hand part of the page will take you to the information about, so in the US, there's energy tax credits for buying certain things or fixing certain things in your home, usually appliances, usually replacing old refrigerators or upgrading your roof or something like that. There's open sourced data, so open data, for downloading all the anonymized return information, aggregate return information by zip code. Now, in a demo, it's really nice to demo really big data. This data set that I've downloaded is for 2008, and it really only has about 200,000 records. So in the big data world, not very big at all, but that's what makes it demo friendly. So what I've done is I've brought that external data into HD Insight along with the metadata about it. So they have documented what each, it's a commented limited file. They've documented what each of the fields are in there, what their data type should be, and what they mean. I do some processing light using Hive that generates a map reduced job that creates a highly, highly aggregated and summarized set of data for that. Bring that in together with a highly, what's the right word? I have messed with the AdventureWorks data warehouse data. So the AdventureWorks data warehouse, you guys are all familiar with that, right? You have all the products, all the people there. So not a lot of energy efficient appliances in that data set. Would you agree? Yeah. So I've kind of wedged some energy efficient by changing, upgrading some of the gloves to be a washer and dryer. And so I've also fudged some of the financials in there because most washer and dryers cost more than $2.29. So I've messed with the data so much, we're all going to go to jail for it, but in order to mash it up with this IRS data. Then after I do that, pull it into Power Query and Power View, which of course means Excel, and show how I'm merging those two data sets together. So the Power BI stack is primarily Power Query, Power View, Power Pivot, and Power Map. I'm only going to be using the first two. Okay, so now we have, we've got some more creating to do though before we go through that. So I talked about PowerShell. So there's Windows Azure PowerShell. And what we do there, We set some variables so that I can keep track of which subscription, which storage account, and which container I'm going to use. And then in order to enable what I want to do, I'm setting the storage account key up. And I love red. Don't you love red? Oh, yeah. This is a cut and paste error on my part. Try that again. Goodness gracious. It's pretty bad. They say don't type in demos. I can't even cut and paste in a demo. Did I not do that? Oh, because it's that's what messed up. Thanks. Let's get that. Did I get the storage account? It's not fun. There we go. Then I have to set context for those. So this is a lot of getting everything set up. So one of the things is that because it's PowerShell, of course, the benefit of doing something in PowerShell is you can script this out. So remember how I talked about how you turn your clusters off? You don't turn them off. You actually delete them in order to stop them. So you would script out all of this creating that I did by hand, and you do all that in PowerShell. So then, now we've got all that set up. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to go find this tax data, comma delimited file that I have on my hard drive, and we're going to pull it in to our blobs. And for the life of me, I can't type blob without typing blog, and so I've asked for an autocorrect to just fix that for me. And then it runs off and does this stuff, and what I found is when I run this on my hotel Wi-Fi, it takes 2 hours. Anyone else have that experience? It's a feature to help you watch more TV. So what that's done now has brought in all that data into a blob, into my container and my storage. And then this is the tricky one. So now I'm going to tell it what cluster I want this to run under. Let me make sure that's the right container's cluster name. And that takes a little bit. So then once that job finishes, once that setting my cluster name, then this is the Hive that I talked about. Do you recognize that as SQL? Oops. What this is doing is creating an external table. External just means that I'm going to create it in this metastore, the metastore that's in that SQL Azure DB. And this is a table that I'm creating out of that comma delimited data, that IRS data. And it basically has in the comma delimited data the state, the zip code, the adjusted gross income as a class. So this is how they anonymize it. So they just chunk up these incomes into about 5 different labels. And then the number of returns and some other information that I'm not using, and then a bunch of fields that I don't really care about, so I didn't bother naming them. And as it's doing all that, really big table, the other part of the syntax is that it tells me how this data is delimited and where it's going to put it. And you notice that the protocol on this URL is WASB. Which makes me wonder, now that we've rebranded this Azure from Windows Azure to Microsoft Azure, we've probably learned not to put brand names into our technical protocols, right? We should make those pretty much unique. So let's see how. Yeah. So here I've been having troubles today where this is taking longer than it should. So I think I'll just walk you through some of the script, because I do have some of this data already done. So then you can see the select statement. So like every good speaker, I'm telling you not to do select star, even though I've done it. But here's just where I would check to see if I, not pull back all the rows, but to see if I got 20. So limit 20 is like top 20. So it would just bring me back randomly 20 rows from that to see how I can do it. Then, oops. My query that I have that I'm going to use, this is where I'm mapping and reducing, even though you don't have to see that, is, oops, sorry. I'm going to select, I'm going to concatenate, which means I'm pulling all this data together, and I'm taking, the math I decided to do was that I was going to find out the average number of returns, as well as I picked AGI classes, adjusted gross income classes, of 5, 6, and 7, which in this underlying data, this is hard-coded, is just people who have adjusted gross incomes of greater than $75,000. So that was an arbitrary thing I picked. And also, this AF5695 is the field that holds the average energy tax credit. So I only want to look at energy tax credits that were $100 or more. So if you think about, if you step back to what this data story is that I want to know people who have a fairly good income because their AGI is 75,000 or more, and who also bothered to apply for these energy tax credits and got more than 100 bucks of it, right? Totally manufactured. So if I were the AdventureWorks retailer, I would say that I'm in from the question, the data story I'm trying to get the questions out of is fairly well-off people who still bother to get energy tax credits, and maybe that's because AdventureWorks is interested in those demographics. So we're not going to the people who make less than adjusted gross income of 75K. I just want to know how they react. So if I put my retailer hat on, the reason that retailers might want to know this is, let's say they were actually considering profit as a motive. I know, that's just so bizarre. Is that they might take, as many retailers do, products that are eligible for the energy tax credits and increase their margins. And the way they might do that is by buying more of them, because there'll be greater demand, because there's a promotion that the government is funding. So they'll buy more of them, reduce their costs, but they'll also bump up their regular retail price on it, so that that increases their margins on both end of that. So that's what I want to know, and in what zip codes that works in. So let's see, did this ever finish? No. But that's okay, because we have some things big. So what that would happen is that after all that crunching and everything, that data will be output into this part of my blob storage. Now, one of the tricky things about HD Insight that gets everybody is before you can put things in a file, you had to have created that. It's not really a folder or directory, it just looks like one. It's actually another blob. And the easiest way to do that is through the Azure Storage Explorer, which you can also download. Yeah, so things aren't authenticating now. That's fun. Let me just close that. That would have allowed me to see all the file and directory structure there. So if I go now, so the other thing I've created, let me just show you, is I created a view in my AdventureWorks database on my machine, only because I'm lazy, that kept track from my traditional data warehouse, the energy efficiency sales by region, which basically mashed up the regions, the zip codes. I summarized sales amounts. This is off the fact table for internet sales, so it's the fact table for all of our sales transactions, and created a total sales account, total sales column. And then I match them up to a new table I created just of our, a new dimension, sorry, of our energy products, just the ones we consider energy efficient products, and group them by territory region, which is like state in that database, in my version of it, and zip code. And there's my key down there if anyone wants to swipe my Azure stuff while I'm not looking. So what I would do in Excel, so now we've got our data in our blobs. It's been mapped and reduced and HD insighted. And if I had a lot of data, I might have done that over 40 nodes. That's not making me happy either. It's Thursday. Even my Excel is tired. So I can close. There we go. So what I have here, those 200,000 rows, I told you, I heavily mapped and reduced them, came down to, these are the results of that view I created, that have of the data that I've crunched down just manually is states, their zip codes, and what the total sales of energy-efficient products have been at AdventureWorks. Then I also have the data, and I'll show you how I brought these in, but basically state and zip code. This is the IRS data that I crunched down by getting the average number of returns for that zip code for people who made, who had an AGI over 75,000 and an average tax credit over 100,000. And the way you bring those things in is through Power Query. And of course, if you've played with these before, for HD Insight, that's what it's called. Oops. Boy, that's not making me happy. So let's do it this way. Let's go see what it is for this one. Where's my, from my database. You can see I have my AdventureWorks data warehouse and my view. And it presents you with a preview of the data from your database. And one of the things you have to be careful about when you bring in, especially data that sometimes developers like to store zip code as integers, but other people store them as values, is you have to know what their data type is. So I can see that now that this is a numeric data type, and so I can transform it. How do I do that? Oh, it is a text. It is a text, so I could convert it the other way. And it has, and I can set the types of numbers that things are and everything like that. So I can go ahead and apply and close. And that brings everything in through Power Query into that. And I can now format it and make it pretty and all of those things. So if I go here, that was my container from before. Then I can also, through Power Query, I can also merge these two data sets, and this is where the power comes in. That I could choose my view, the data from my view, and I could choose my data from HD Insight and say, I want to match these two on zip code. And it will go and do a query behind the scenes, pull in that data together. That I want there. And now I have my state, my zip code, the total sales from my warehouse, plus the average AGI from the IRS data and the average tax credit. And I can go ahead and bring those in. And now I've pulled those all together. That external data from Hadoop. It's just going to keep showing me this authorization problem. So the other thing I can do, so I had that data pre-merged over here, and you can see how, of course, I had some data for some zip codes in the data warehouse that I hadn't done any sales for. So this represents the IRS data matched up against those zip codes that I'd managed to crunch out some data. So if I look at it this way, a smart user could look at and see that, wow, this Hawaiian zip code did pretty well. These did pretty well. This Hawaiian one didn't. What's up with California? You'd think that California would have these massive amounts of total sales of energy-efficient things. So the reason I crunched the data this way, or fudged the data this way for the demo, is we actually had a case in a retailer I was working at where the energy credit items, the things that were eligible for energy credits, those retailers didn't carry in a certain state. And it was either because they were merchandising incorrectly, there could have been something else about those appliances that were illegal in that state, there could have been all kinds of reasons. So if you want to take advantage of this promotion of doing energy tax credits, then in theory, you should know how your sales are working against those. So you could go back and change your merchandising mix, you could make sure the data was recorded correctly, all of those things. But doing this in a table, of course, isn't nearly as fun as doing it in PowerView, where you can map all this stuff automatically onto a map. In this case, I have our energy efficient product sales, and I can see through these bubbles that for this zip code, for this zip code in Illinois, I did pretty well, $500,000 in sales that year for these energy efficient things. But look at Hawaii. Hawaii is really standing out in all this data, and you might have noticed that in the spreadsheet. And this data visualization allows me to see that. But what it really allows is end users to do this self-serve, where they'd never be able to do all that by managing their own Hadoop ecosystem. And then we have, let's see, what else did I do? Nope, still a map, but a map of now the tax credits. And some charts I all pulled together with the actual data. And this is all pointed to the live data. If I wasn't having the authorization issues, I could refresh this so I could schedule this to update when I opened it. I can see that also from the bubble chart, I can also verify through the bar chart and through the data that indeed there's something going on well, really well in Hawaii with all these energy tax credit and the merchandising mix that we're selling there. It could be that Hawaiians are really excited about saving money or really excited about buying energy efficient appliances. I'm not sure, but now I have yet another data story that I could pursue. The other data story I could pursue is over time. Like I'd like to see if I loaded in all the IRS data going back and got data coming forward, I could see the impact of these energy efficient tax credits on our sales over time to see if there actually was at least a correlation between those things or at least try to influence how that line and trend goes. So those are all what we've done so far is we brought in data from the IRS, we loaded it in a storage blob, we mapped and reduced it via Hive query, so SQL related query. We pulled it all together. We've now brought it and mashed it up and merged it with our traditional warehouse things in very small data sets, I'll admit, but that works well for demos. And then we've produced through Power BI. We could add this also to pivot tables, anything that we could, once we've gotten this data into Excel, then we could do all the things that are there, including the spinny map and drill down things of Power Map. So do we have any questions about sort of that whole data story and life cycle that happened here? No? Really loud. So where do I see all this fitting with regular analysis services and everything? So again, it's a good fit because the power of using big data technologies is getting those data sets smaller. So we could still, that data is still on the cloud now. We could bring that down and feed that in directly to analysis services. We could report on it through reporting services. Like it's just data, right? It's just now one of the things I didn't talk about in the billing part is the other reason to use HD Insight is if you thought about like a typical big data thing might be billions of rows. If you had to bring billions of rows into your cubes or into your tabular models, and process them there and persist them in your enterprise SQL Server on-premises things, there'd be a certain cost to that, right? That cost would be very large servers, very expensive price when you might not care about all of that streaming item data. So we use the cost, benefit, and risk to use the HD Insights so that we can fire those things up, process them, and get that data, that the actual information we wanted. So in my case, energy credits from people who made over $75,000 a year and all of those things. And then it's just data that you can bring in and download. And I talked about how also the cost model is, You know, you don't pay to put all that big data up. You pay to leave it there. But then to bring it out, you're bringing out a much smaller set. And so the cost of these 10 rows that I brought out of those 200,000 rows is very small. So again, it becomes down to cost, benefit, and risk. Any other questions about what we did here? The last thing I wanted to show you was that I showed you the pricing details, but the thing I encourage you to do is to go sign up for an Azure. You can go get a $200 credit for 1 month to go play with all this stuff. There's lots of data sources out there. In addition to, there's the Windows Azure Data Marketplace that has many of these data sets that you can bring in, or APIs against them. But you can also go to opendata.gov or opendata.gc.ca, if I can put the spin in for the Canadian. Every country now is participating in these open data sets. So things like weather data and space data and census data and everything that you could start mashing up to try to get more insights into the data you already have. And $200 is a lot of money. Like, you don't go spin up 40 nodes. That gets really pricey really fast. But you can spin up, you know, one or four node thing. You can have your SQL DBs. This is what I find the great time now to start learning the Azure technologies, because of this 1 month credit that you can use to do all these things. And when I play with the Azure SQL database, because I'm not putting big data in there, that's costing me like pennies a day to play with the data that's there and to play with the technologies that are there. Let's go back to see what we have here. So to wrap it all up, if you take the HD Insight, and oh, one of the other things, if I had swag that I could give away, I would have given away to everyone who reminded me it's not HD Insights, it's HD Insight, it's singular. Because we've all learned that Power Query, Power View, Power Pivot, they all have a space in the name now, right? We all know that. So this is the other thing you have to remember, is that together with that, with your traditional data warehouse and some external data and Power BI, allows you to find that right cost, benefit, and risk story that you need to do some of the insightful things that you can bring to your customers and to your business partners that you work with, because we didn't really have an easy way of dealing with that right now. And now we can, through the virtual of HD Insight in the cloud. And that's all we have. Yeah, look at all these nice slides. So all these breakout sessions are probably already over because we're on the last day. But some related things about PDW and APS, the appliance-based versions of some of the same technologies we talked about. Also using HD Insight and some other big data things. And there were labs here. And you've seen all these things. These are new. And I think you should win an Xbox, for sure. And I'll be up here to answer a few more questions if you have them, but you can scan this QR code. Please do fill out the evaluation. It's two questions, takes 10 seconds. If you want to leave a comment in there about anything you'd like to have seen different in this, I'd really appreciate it. That's the best gift that you can give a speaker, is to provide them constructive feedback and to fill out the evaluations. So thank you very much, and come on up if you need a tweet now. Or a hug. Tom will give you a hug.